Syrian government forces enter an area held by militants in southern province of Daraa after 10 years under a surrender deal. Hamas says Israeli attacks on Gaza are an attempt by Tel Aviv to divert attention from the escape of Palestinian inmates from its high-security jail. Pakistani passenger plane has touched down at Kabul, becoming the first foreign commercial flight to arrive there since the Taliban's takeover. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zanjefi. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with Syria, the army there has entered Al-Yadudah township in the country's southern province of Daraa after 10 years. The army reportedly entered the area with Russian troops. According to local media, the entry followed a Russian-brokered surrender deal with militants that came into effect on September the 1st. The deal allowed the army to take control of the strategic Daraa al-Balad and gave residents an opportunity to return to their homes. Under the agreement, the militants must either leave the area or surrender their firearms if they choose to remain. Russia mediated the deal after weeks of tensions between the army and the militants. Daraa al-Balad was the last stronghold of the militants in southern Syria. Now let's get some more information regarding this. So we'll go to Damascus. Mohammed Ali, our correspondent, definitely knows more about this. Mohammed, what do you have to tell us and add to this information?
Yes, the Syrian army this morning entered the Al-Yadudah town, which is about 7 kilometers northwest of the city of Daraa itself. Of course, for years, the Syrian army was not able to enter due to the presence of armed groups inside. But now, it seems that a peaceful deal has been reached, similar to the one that was reached several days ago in Daraa al-Balad, which is a larger, of course, area. And it seems that this indicates that there's just this kind of trust now between those armed groups and the Syrian government. This is for the first time being seen over there in those parts of Daraa. The Syrian army entered. A reconciliation center has been opened. Over 40 armed men headed to that center for reconciliation and for surrendering their arms. And similar to the Daraa al-Balad deal, the Syrian army will perhaps establish checkpoints to ensure security and stability over there. Now, this deal was not a surprise, because after the Daraa al-Balad deal was reached, the notables of the western countryside of Daraa sent messages to the Syrian government that they are willing to engage in a similar deal to the one that happened, of course, in Daraa al-Balad. And it is expected that more and more villages that are under the control of armed groups over there in the countryside of Daraa will follow those areas of Daraa al-Balad and Al-Yadudah. Definitely, this is very important. Economically speaking, this would ensure the safety of a route between Syria and Jordan for trade exchange. Economically speaking, this will also give a chance for all of the residents in southern Syria to go back to normal life. It will give them a chance to rebuild the areas that were affected by the war for 10 years over there. So definitely this is important for all sides, for the residents and for even the armed men who reconciled. They will have a chance to live their normal life back again. Mm-hmm. It's a very important deal, and more will be following according to reports on the ground.
And hopefully the same will happen elsewhere in Syria. Thank you very much for that, Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus. Now, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas saying that fresh Israeli air raids on Gaza are an attempt by that regime to divert attention from the successful escape of inmates from its high-security jail. Hamas spokesman says that the response to the airstrikes on Gaza and anger across the West Bank indicate the people's support for those behind bars. The spokesman underlined that the regime has been unable to impose its will on the Palestinian nation. Early in the day, Israeli warplanes again pounded areas across the besieged Palestinian strip. Israel claims that the airstrikes are in response to rockets fired from Gaza. New tensions flared up after six Palestinians escaped the regime's Gilboa prison last week. Now, our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, says that the recent Israeli airstrikes on Gaza targeted empty training centers and security posts because the regime doesn't want to escalate the situation now.
I believe that the reason the Israeli regime forces avoided killing Palestinians over the last few days during their attacks as they hit empty training centers and security posts that belong to Hamas's military wing, the Qassam Brigades, and also Islamic Jihad's Al-Quds Brigades, because they don't want to escalate the situation, because they know well, they know very well that if they kill a resistance fighter or kill someone in Gaza through their airstrikes, combined with the situation with of the prisoners right now, could force the resistance factions in Gaza to fire hundreds, maybe thousands of projectiles towards the Israeli regime. And Israel right now is will not be happy about it, because they're celebrating Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and also other holidays in the coming days.
Israeli forces have demolished a house belonging to a Palestinian family southeast of Tel Aviv. The regime has not cited any reason for destroying the house in the city of Lod. The move is the latest in a series of demolition of Palestinian homes by Israel recently. The regime uses different pretexts to destroy Palestinian homes and structures on a regular basis. Palestinians and rights groups say that the Israeli demolition drive is aimed at grabbing more land for its settlement expansion that's illegal under international law. The UN Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. It's news review time. Do stay with us. Now, Iran has slammed the West for what it calls shameful double standard in dealing with nuclear-armed Israel. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that the West has not only failed to put pressure on Israel to join the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, but it also fully supported the regime. The official noted that Iran would continue to push for the disarmament of Israel and a nuke-free West Asia. The spokesman said that Israel, that's believed to be in possession of hundreds of nukes, is in no position to lecture NPT member states like Iran. Last week, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid accused Iran of marching toward a nuclear weapon. Lapid said that Israel will act if the world fails to stop Iran. Okay, now time to get some insight and see what other things about this. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. Also, Mimi Alham, journalist and writer with Al Mayed in English, will join us from Perth. So, Mick, is this a joke or what? Israel will stop Iran if the world fails to do that? What are they talking about? Iran, everybody knows about Iran's missile activity. 15 IAEA reports confirm that the nuclear program Iran is pursuing is peaceful, is not diverted toward military purposes. So what's Tel Aviv talking about?
Well, you use the word joke, but it's certainly a very sick joke. Let's look at the basic record, which is open, and anyone can check this. France and the UK helped Israel to develop its secret nuclear capability. I can't remember, it was France or Britain supplied the heavy water, but all the technology that reached Israel didn't come from the USA at that time, it came from Europe. But Israel is now determined to preserve its monopoly of nuclear weapons in West Asia. And that monopoly is very important to Israel. Look, it was openly discussed in the Israeli press that when Israel was losing the war in the early stages against Egypt in 73, Moshe Dayan pressed the defense minister, pressed the prime minister to use nuclear weapons against Egypt. Now, she at that time said no, but the threat to use nuclear weapons was used as a threat to America, to force America to massively increase its sales weapons to Israel during that crisis, during that war. And therefore, the use of nuclear the value of nuclear weapons is not just in their use, it's in the threat to use them. And Israel's the only country in the Middle East and West Asia which has them, but which has also threatened to use them. Look, 2 years after that, and here's another argument why Israel cannot be trusted with nuclear weapons. I don't think Israel can be trusted with very much. But 2 years after 73, because the apartheid regime in South Africa later fell, we see the documents. And Shimon Peres was offering to sell nuclear weapons to the apartheid regime in South Africa. It seems like a comedy script. But he said we can give them in two sizes. And these documents are in the public domain at the moment. 10 years later, Israel bombed Iraq. You don't have to be a fan of Saddam Hussein to pay attention to this. Because when the Israelis bombed the Iraqi reactor, the Israeli Prime Minister at the time, Begin, he said, every Israeli government will act in a similar way whenever they suspect, as in can claim, that any of their neighbors are a nuclear threat to Israel. Shortly after that, Mordechai Vanunu, a humble engineer in Israel's nuclear plant, gave his story for free to the Western press, proving that Israel had not just atom bombs, but hydrogen bombs. He was kidnapped, injected from Rome, taken to Israel, and almost 40 years later, he's still detained in Israel for revealing the extent of Israel's nuclear weapons. And Vanunu revealed the arsenal at that time, in 86, right, because he said it could not possibly just be for defensive purposes. So the record shows that there is massive Western collusion in Israel's nuclear arsenal, and it's protected. You know, there have been resolutions to the IAEA to force Israel to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The US, UK, and Canada have consistently voted against even such motions as asking Israel to open its weapons to international
Exactly, yeah. And I want to put that question to Mimi Alham. The US, UK, France, and others, they are stopping this. Nukes are threats to everyone. It doesn't matter if you're a Jew, Muslim, or whatever. Nukes are nukes, right? So nukes, if Iran pursues it or other countries, it's a threat. If Israel doesn't pursue it, it's not a threat?
Well, it's interesting. I believe a couple of years ago, the Russians came out with a report saying that Israel had 80 to 100 nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. And clearly, like, this number of bombs could annihilate an entire country. And once they go flying into the air, of course, that means that everyone's going to increase. This is the doctrine, mutually assured destruction, the belief that once someone uses nukes, it's possible everyone's going to start using nukes. And so this has, of course, a nightmarish scenario associated with it. The problem is that the nukes already exist. The United States, the UK, Russia already have them, of course, France and China and India and Pakistan as well. And illegally, Israel acquired them. This is already, they don't admit it, but Vanunu himself was a nuclear scientist who exposed this. Of course, the Israelis put him in jail for that. So given that Israel is not prepared to give up its nukes, and it's prepared to point the finger at other countries accusing them of nukes and making threats about nukes, I think it is actually in Iran's interest, and perhaps in the interest to stability in the region, to get nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Nick, what do you have to say then?
Well, I would like to see, like most of the people in the Middle East, I would like to see a nuclear-free area. Nuclear weapons, and my own government has nuclear weapons and has refused to sign an offer-strike agreement. Nuclear weapons kill children, infants, pensioners, innocent, everybody. They exterminate cities. So they are hellish. They're fiendish weapons and should never be used. The only country that's ever used them was the USA, which used them on Japan when Japan was on the verge of surrender. Israel has threatened to use them in 1973. So they should never be used. They are absolutely inhuman. And I'm glad the Iranian government has pledged not to use them. But Israel reserves the right to use them. And they discuss openly in their staff colleges the so-called Samson option, which is that if, as in 1973, they don't just lose a war for the first few days, but they're on the verge of losing a war, then the Samson option means they will use nuclear weapons on their neighbors. And that is virtually an open threat. Look, Shimon Peres offers to sell these weapons to apartheid South Africa. Only 6 years ago, Netanyahu thanked Kerry, the American government foreign minister, I forget his official title, he thanked Kerry for preventing a conference taking place for a nuclear-free West Asia, a nuclear-free Middle East. Egypt wanted it. All the countries in that area wanted it, except Israel and the USA. And Netanyahu's public thanks, which is reported widely in the Israeli press, Netanyahu's public thank you to Kerry for protecting Israel's nuclear monopoly, for even preventing a public diplomatic discussion of a nuclear-free area. That tells you the lie of the land. My own government plays a despicable role in this. They align with the USA to protect the Israeli nuclear monopoly, which can be used to intimidate the area short of actual use.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh, and also Mimi Alaham, journalist and writer with Al Mayadeen English, joined us from Perth with their contribution. And that's all for this edition of the News Review. Now, moving on, a Pakistani passenger plane has touched down at Kabul Airport, becoming the first foreign commercial flight to arrive there since the Taliban's takeover. A journalist aboard a flight from Islamabad was quoted as saying that there was more staff than passengers aboard. A spokesman for the Pakistani airline says that the flight will carry people holding valid travel documents from Kabul. The airport was severely damaged during a chaotic evacuation of 120,000 people that ended with the withdrawal of U.S. forces on August 30th. The Taliban have been trying to get it operating again with technical assistance from Qatar and some other countries. Qatar Airways operated several charter flights out of Kabul last week, while an Afghan airliner resumed domestic services on September the 3rd. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Economic divide.
The fall of the U.S. dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there's a decline in the U.S. standing as a superpower, there's also the harsh reality that the U.S. is facing, the decline of the U.S. dollar. Hi, I'm Kavitah Lee. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at whether the fall of the U.S. dollar is hyped or whether it is really happening, like a slow death for the U.S. Coming up in today's program, the share of the U.S. dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. What does that mean? Is that a move away from the dollar? That is a key question that we'll be looking at in this program. Another one of the highlights is how U.S. debt is playing a role in the decline of the dollar. There's a sovereign debt crisis that the U.S. is experiencing. Is that a reason for the dollar to collapse? We will examine the ways that that may be happening. And finally, we will take a look at something that the U.S. is using called dollar weaponization. The key instrument, sanctions. And the countries that are at the receiving end of it, at least some of them, are Iran, Russia, and China. Stay tuned.
The dollar is king. That is the saying.
Well, the dollar is very strong. The country is very strong. The dollar is it's a beautiful thing in one way, but it makes it harder to compete. And despite that, but we have a very powerful dollar.
But it has been losing its value for quite some time. This new worry, COVID-19. Investors are worried the U.S. response is dealing a blow to the dollar, its status as the world's reserve currency declining.
With the recent gold price rally, and fueled by the ongoing and growing socioeconomic issues, the USD's position as the world's reserve currency might be threatened.
Investors and analysts, including billionaire hedge fund manager Ray Dalio and Goldman Sachs Group strategist, are warning that massive U.S. government spending in recent months could hurt the U.S. dollar. At the same time, rock-bottom U.S. interest rates for the foreseeable future and concerns over potential rise in inflation are denting the dollar's appeal.
What we've seen this go around is the need to distribute, to produce a lot of debt. Where did those checks come from? They came from the government. The government wrote the checks. But the government can't produce money. The central bank can produce money.
These factors are already weighing in on the dollar, which stands 9% below its high of the year and had its worst monthly performance in a decade for the month of July.
When there has to be a lot of selling of bonds, and bonds don't give any good return, there's a guaranteed negative return in bonds relative to inflation. And there's a pile of people who own bonds. And this isn't just Americans, but these are international investors owning bonds. And they have to buy a lot more bonds, because when the government has to sell a lot more debt, that means they have to buy a lot more bonds. There will not be enough demand for those bonds.
There's also the real issue about the economic policies of major governments of the world. The declining value of the U.S. dollar has come about because the investment community sees the U.S. government following a more expansive economic program than the other major governments.
It's a critical market. Let's face it, China's the world's second largest economy. It's one of the fastest growing major economies today. We've all seen some of the economic challenges of the world over the last 2 years with COVID and some of the struggles to recover from that. China was kind of first in and first out, and so has done recovered very quickly.
The U.S. dollar has been declining in value for quite some time. The key question is why. Also, we keep hearing about the fall of the dollar as the top currency of choice, but actual numbers prove otherwise. First, the fall. That is true. Since March 2020, its decline has moved steadily after the U.S. presidential elections. In the middle of July, July 15 to be exact, the WSJ dollar index was 90.57. Just before the election that happened on November 3, the index stood at 88.25. Then the decline in the value of the U.S. dollar picked up steam. Why did the U.S. start losing its value due to Biden's election win? Well, because the U.S. President Biden at this point has taken a more aggressive stance with respect to the economy. Just take a look at this $6 trillion budget plan. Now, this was proposed in May, which did not get fully approved, included the following: a $1.5 trillion request for operating expenditures for the Pentagon and other government departments. It also incorporated two plans that he had previously publicized: a $2.3 trillion jobs plan and a $1.8 trillion family plan. That's quite a lot, isn't it? And we're also going to cover how that affects the standing of the dollar. Well, joining us in the studio is our guest, Ahmad Salehi. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us. He is an economic analyst, and he has a specialty in the management of industrial projects. And this is his Twitter address, @AhmadSalehi _MEY May. And also, he is active on Instagram, Ahmad dot Salehi Cohen Official is his address on Instagram. So welcome. Obviously, our topic is the dollar, and my key question here is a general one. Why the U.S. dollar is used as a reserve currency? It's most often used in trade, given the fact that there are other currencies, and it still is the reserve currency of choice. I mean, the whole international financial system seems to be structured around the U.S. dollar. What's the reason? I mean, does the U.S. have a monopoly over it?
My pleasure to be here.
Sure.
Actually, the whole thing is a matter of trust, and a plain check that the world gave the United States in Bretton Woods. What was the underlying foundation that gave the United States this power was the old cold myth that wars are good for the economy of the United States. You have to carefully study the history of the First and Second World War. Actually, when the world was in a war during both the world wars, the United States was providing the world with goods and material, but it was not getting currency, but gold in compensation. So, during these two world wars, two-thirds of the gold reserves of the central banks was accumulated in Federal Reserve. So, this was the first common foundation that gave the authority of the United States in Bretton Woods to actually dominate its dollar.
Okay, let's fast forward then. Thank you for that history check on that. Hopefully that answers a lot of questions regarding the dollar back then and its beginning. But we're going to take a look at two different vantage points in the way that the dollar is being covered. First, we're going to take a look at this graph. It says the IMF's new data shows that the share of the U.S. dollar reserves held by central banks fell to 59%. That is the lowest level in 25 years. And that happened during the fourth quarter of 2020. Mm-hmm. So it's very recent, pretty recent, actually. So that's one way that the dollar is being covered. Then you have this falling clip and its take on how the dollar is doing right now.
Even as the coronavirus pandemic wreaked havoc across global markets, wiping out trillions of dollars worth of assets, the U.S. dollar was unaffected by the turmoil. At one point, it soared 4% against a basket of major currencies, namely the euro, pound, yen, Canadian dollar, Swiss franc, and Swedish krona.
So on the one hand, you have that in terms of the reserves falling to its lowest level in 25 years, and then you have what it said here, that during the pandemic, the dollar actually rose, and it actually gained strength against the other currencies in the basket.
Yes. Actually, we have to take a look at it from a wider span. There are reasons that the empire of dollar is dominant in the world. We can simplify it into four pillars. The first pillar is the trade of the energy, mainly oil in the world, which is purely done by dollar. The second pillar is the IMF and the World Bank as the regulators of the fiscal and monetary policies throughout the world. And the third pillar is the WTO, which is the main function of WTO is spreading and increasing and promoting the global trade, and we know that the global trade is done via dollar. And the last, actually, pillar is the reserves, the currency reserves of the central banks. So if you want to have a better look at what is going on and what will be the future, we have to study carefully these four pillars. Of course, there are some internal factors also inside the United States economy. We're talking about the socio-economical parameters like the demographic of the population, the age of the population, which is getting older and older. But regardless of the internal factors of United States economy, when we look at these four pillars, we see that all of them are changing, not with a very rapid speed, but with a steady one.
We're going to have you back a little later on in the program, but for now, thank you very much for that, Ahmad Salehi. We do appreciate your comments, obviously very insightful there. So you heard some of the explanation that was given there by Ahmad Salehi. Our next piece is going to take a look at the U.S. dollar, but in terms of the debt that it has accumulated, how that plays into the picture. And obviously with that comes the printing of the greenback, as you're about to find out.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. We are going to take a look at the U.S. dollar and why it's called a petrodollar. You may have heard the term, and how that is actually under threat. Now, the petrodollar, by definition, is any U.S. dollar that's paid to oil-exporting countries in exchange for oil. The dollar, as you know, is the preeminent global currency. That's how it's been. As a result, most international transactions, including oil, are priced in petrodollars. Now, oil-exporting nations actually receive dollars for their exports, but not in their own currency. Now, the question comes about in terms of how oil is pegged to the dollar and not to another currency. I mean, that's a viable question. Now, why that is, it's due to a 1945 U.S.-Saudi agreement which created the petrodollar. That's when it was born. What benefits comes from that, the petrodollar, for the U.S., that is? Well, it provides three immediate benefits: increasing global demand for U.S. dollars, increasing global demand for U.S. debt securities, and it also gives the U.S. this ability to buy oil with a currency that it can print at will. Think about that. That's a very important advantage that this brings for the United States. Now, most oil-exporting nations, such as Saudi Arabia and Iraq, for example, own their oil industries, and since they receive their payments in dollars, that makes their national income dependent on the dollar's value. So that means if the dollar falls, so does the government's revenue. Now, since they don't want to lose their payments value, most of these oil exporters have pegged their currencies to the dollar. And what does that do? Well, if the dollar value falls, so does the price of all of their domestic goods and services. Now, that helps these countries avoid wide swings in either inflation or deflation. Now, let's take a look at this question, how the dollar can actually be threatened. Well, just think about how oil is pegged to the dollar. All economies are oil-based. Pretty much a lot of things you see around you have some connection to oil in one way or another. So if there was a shift from oil to other renewable energy sources, that could threaten the petrodollar. So hopefully that makes sense to you. I mean, if you take a look at it, on the one hand, you have what's happening, the switch to renewable green energy, which threatens the dollar. And the other hand, you have countries which the dollar is shunned since it is being weaponized against them by the U.S. That's another point that needs to be considered here. Well, to explain this a little bit more for us, David Barkin, he's a professor of economics at the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana from Mexico, who joins us. He was a founding member of the Eco Development Center in 1974, for which he was awarded the National Prize in Political Economy. David, welcome. The dollar as a reserve currency falling out of favor with a number of countries like Russia, China, Iran, Pakistan, Nigeria, to name a few. Now, these countries have been on the receiving end of sanctions due to political fallouts that they've had with the U.S. What are the pros and cons in dumping a dollar in their bilateral trade?
Well, I think that the expression you use, dumping the dollar, is unfortunately not very relevant for many of those countries, because they're doing trade with international corporations, with private parties that are demanding payment in dollars for these transactions.
David Barkin there. And of course, he made a great distinction. However, next up is going to be a report on how the U.S. actually uses the dollar as a weapon, the countries involved, but more so the focus being the process that it goes through in order to enforce its what's called sanctions regime.
The U.S. is weaponizing the dollar to keep its global standing. It is is convinced of an existential threat from competitors. It does this to maintain its global economic and geopolitical position. Others disagree with U.S.'s approach. The U.S. accounts for about 20% of the world's economic output, and more than half of all global currency reserves and trade is in dollars. This was the result of the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreements, when each member agreed to redeem its currency for U.S. dollars, not gold.
So let me start with the debt cycle. You know, in 1945, we began a new world order. 1944, we created a new monetary system, the Bretton Woods monetary system. And then we created that new world order. And that created a bull markets in stocks and an American world order for the most part. There's a cycle that we're used to, in which whenever you have an economic downturn, the central bank hits the gas and can create debt expansion, and that produces an increase in demand.
The dollar's pivotal role allows the U.S. to easily finance its trade and budget deficits. It protects it against balance of payments crises because it imports its goods and services, borrowing in its own currency. U.S. monetary policies, like quantitative easing, can influence the value of the dollar. This gives the currency and the U.S. competitive advantage. The real power of the dollar, however, is its harsh sanctions program. This is the consultation process to enforce the sanctions. When all of these departments are combined, they provide the force needed to go after the worldwide monetary financial system known as SWIFT, with the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications Business. When combined with access that it gained to data from SWIFT, the U.S. exerts unprecedented control over global economic activity. U.S. sanctions target people, entities, officials, or even an entire country.
There's no denying it. Some major economies are dumping the dollar or drawing down the reserves of the dollar. Actually, those are two separate issues, as our guests have indicated. Now, the countries we can mention here are China, Russia, and Iran, but what if the outcome of this is for the U.S. to actually threaten military action against them? Now, this was mentioned in an opinion piece written by Shannon Abraham. She said in order to avert a sudden dollar collapse, the U.S. has taken robust measures in the past to avoid this, and went as far as militarily, that is, threatening to attack or attacking other countries that are dumping the dollar. Some examples, the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, or former President Saddam Hussein, announcing that Iraq would no longer sell its U.S. or its oil in the U.S. dollars. That's one example. We can take a look at Libya. In 2011, NATO to have attacked it in order to thwart the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, to create a gold-backed African currency in dinars, if you remember that. He also pushed African and Middle Eastern governments to dump the dollar. All right, our in-house guest joins us, Ahmad Saleh, rejoins us for his final comments. We also have David Barkin, economist, also rejoining us. Okay, Ahmad, so the final question here, this theory that I just talked about, countries that are dumping the dollar from the trade where they want to eliminate the dollar, it seems like there is this relationship or connection being made that they are being targeted by the U.S. Militarily, perhaps, or that being actually the focus, Syria, Libya, Iraq, Iran being threatened by the U.S. on a number of occasions, and Russia and China also high on the radar of the U.S. Do you agree that in order to avert a sudden dollar collapse, the U.S. has taken these types of measures which involve militarily attacking the countries?
Yes, it's very interesting, and you came up with some examples. If you study the nuclear dossier of Iran, during the 12 months before these two sanctions being applied, there was no major incident happening on the ground in terms of the nuclear activities. If you go study in the history, you see that there is nothing done previously when Iran was doing, for example, the 20% enrichment. There was a new sanction being applied by United Nations or Security Council. But the 12 months prior to the crippling sanctions of the central bank cut off from the SWIFT and the oil, there was absolutely no activity on the ground with regard to the nuclear dossier. But Ahmadinejad stepped into the very into a very new dangerous path, and that was ditching the dollar. like the same as Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein did.
Let me turn our attention now to David. David, you heard our guest there, and you know, we're looking at the countries that are dumping the dollar at this point from their trade, and there's an association being made that they are being militarily perhaps targeted by the U.S., which in the past we can talk about Syria, Libya, and Iraq, all attacked by the U.S., of course, Libya through NATO. And then you have countries like Russia and China and Iran who are being threatened by the U.S. Do you think that there's a correlation there, that the U.S. actually targets these countries militarily?
I'm not sure that the United States' use of military force or the threat of military force against these countries that you mentioned is the result of these countries dumping the dollar per se, as much as these countries trying to develop their own internal development strategies, trying to develop a reasonable path for internal stability and well-being.
All right, David Barkin there. Unfortunately, we just don't have any more time to continue this discussion. I'm sure we're going to have you back, but thank you very much, Ahmad.
One point.
Sure. Go ahead.
About the JFK, I was talking about the executive order 11110. That was a very important executive order by U.S. President, and this order was empowering the U.S. Treasury to issue real note. We were talking about issuing real dollar for the first time and for the last time in history, parallel to Federal Reserve. So he had a plan, because as you know, Federal Reserve is the only central bank which is a private entity.
Right. Exactly.
So it was the
not many people know
Kennedy's
that actually.
Yeah.
It's not common.
It
knowledge.
Was the Kennedy's plan to take the power from the private sector of the so-called bankers or Illuminatis and to give it to the nation of the United States. We are talking about the government.
Thank you for that. Very insightful. We appreciate it. Ahmad Salehi, political economic
Thank
analyst. Let me mention again your Twitter address, @AhmadSalehi_May, and also at Instagram, ahmad.salehi.official. Thank you for your contribution to the program.
Thank you, too.
The story of the dollar decline has been around for over a decade. There is no question that the decline is happening. As long as oil is pegged to the dollar will retain its strength in one way or another. But not so fast. The U.S. has single-handedly led itself down the path of the dollar decline. Massive spending, enormous printing of the dollar, well, those factors have accelerated the decline. And by weaponizing the dollar, many countries have shied away from it. By the way, COVID-19 may be the last straw. With a strong yuan, the dollar will literally have a run for the money. That does it for this edition of the program. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Ikove Tahwei and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we started looking at corruption as it is the key to removing, demolishing, destroying, eliminating, choose the word they like, of human rights, or when it comes to human rights. It is the key to me and you losing our basic rights through the form of corruption. Although corruption differs from country to country, it is possible, however, to identify some of the key common drive forces that generates it, right? So if we do a bit of comparison between countries, or if we do a collective process when it comes to information, we can see there are common grounds between countries when it comes to corruption. What is common to all countries, which are among the most corrupted, have been identified by Sevenson, which is a person who done a bit of work in that research. And he says all of them are developing countries. So all these common factors when it comes to corruption are in developing countries, or countries in transition, as he puts it, with rare exception, low-income countries. Most countries have a closed economy. The influence of religion is visible, where if you have a religious country, obviously the corruption becomes less. As he says, Protestant countries have far less level of corruption. Low media freedom and relatively low level of education. These are the keys or common grounds or common factors that generates corruption. So when you have, you know, when the economy is closed, for example, when there is no influence of religion present, because morality plays a massive role when it comes to corruption. When the religion is not visible in a community or in a country, the rate of corruption goes higher. When there's no media freedom, which means that I don't see who's stealing and who's doing all the corruption, then I can't do much about it. So if the state, if the government controls the media, obviously they're not going to put, documentaries or interviews or on the news that this person in power, in parliament, in the Senate, wherever he might be, was corrupted. I don't see it because the media has low freedom. And when you have a country that is low in education, when the education is really bad, you're not going to give back to community educated people. And with low educated people, obviously there is more corruption, because let's say most students don't get to make it to university. They will drop out. They become a dropouts, in college, for example. And they tend to choose a quick way to make ends meet. They're not going to do something, relatively high for society. They will just think of themselves. And even those who make it to university in the countries who are relatively low, when they have a low level of education, those who make it to power, they will abuse their power because they see themselves superior to the rest. So education plays a massive role. So regardless of the things that we have mentioned, corruption cannot be assessed unambiguously, since there is never only one phenomenon that is responsible for the occurrence and the development of such corruption. Corruption always arises from an area of civil interrelated factors, which can differ considerably from one to another. So we can't really say, well, that is the main cause for corruption, or that is the key for corruption. It comes from different areas. Among the most common, the ones that we mentioned, factors that influence the development of corruption, obviously, be it political, economical, and ethics, and education. So these are the ones that are mainly the driving force of corruption. And we will look at them one by one in episodes to come. Now, before we continue, let us take a break, and then we come back.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. Just before the break, we were looking at the fact that corruption differs from one place to another, and we mentioned some key points or common keys that generates corruption. Corruption will occur if the current gains is greater than the penalty multiplied by the likelihood of being caught or prosecuted. That's just a quote I brought from Wikipedia. Which means what? Which means that when you see that you got more to gain and the penalty to that is less, then I will indulge and you will indulge yourself in it, right? Which is quite selfish. So when we ask the question, what are the causes of corruption? Or where does corruption come from? There's a list of causes. Obviously, we can't, you know, list all of them and say, well, this is the exact key. But it comes from, you know, certain issues that arises within the person himself first and foremost. So if I need to indulge in for example, corruption, let's assume bribery, it comes from within me, right? So among the list of causes of corruption, one, greed of money and desire. And obviously, that's the cause of all evil, right? When I have greed when it comes to money, and money is number one factor that drives people crazy. And even the Quran says, زِيِّنَ لَهُمْ حَبُّ الشَّهَوَاتِ مِنَ الْمَالِ. Allah says, you know, it was desired for them, money, and then Allah lists the rest. So when it comes to money, that's my weak point, or the weak point of every human being. So if I am not a moral person, if I am not a religious person, if I am not a person that has values and a moral code, I will, you know, my desires will become the driving force for me to obtain wealth in a, let's say, an unholy way, right? So instead of me working, or even if I'm working, I would try to increase my wealth through trying to, you know, take it from other people, either by bribes or force or what have you. So greed is number one drive when it comes to corruption. And desire, of course. When you want something, you desire something, sometimes you might not be greedy, but you say, you know what, I want that thing. And then you would seek it in any way possible because your desire drives you through it. So greed for money and desire are among the causes for corruption, which is something that me and you need to be very aware of when it comes to our personal life, when it comes to my inner self, because corruption originates from within before it takes effect on the outside. Now, I'll leave it up to here, and we will look at other causes in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.